Theology.
Theology.
Unplugged.
Okay, I just want to take a minute and talk to you guys about the ontological argument of all things. Ontological argument for the existence of God. And I want this to go well beyond the ontological, because it does go well beyond the ontological. Let me start by saying this. You know, it's one of the big, four arguments for the existence of God. You got the teleological, cosmological, ontological, and the moral. So, the big four. I mean, there's other ones, and you can put these into different categories, Reformed arguments or evidentialism, and there's all kinds of ways to break it up. But these are traditionally the big four arguments for the existence of God. The one that has gotten the least amount of attention is the ontological, because it is the most difficult to understand. It's the most difficult to define. Most people, whenever you explain the ontological, you might state it correctly in its form, but it doesn't mean you have any idea what is going on there. And the only reason I say that is because I've taught the ontological argument for 20 years before I realized what it was. As a matter of fact, it's only been within the last few years that I have come to a conclusion that this argument is not only a solid argument, the Anselmic version, not just some redefined Kantian version or even a version from Plantinga. I think the original Anselmic argument is just fine, because I think you can take what he's doing based upon other things. Now, the reason why I get this now, the reason why I understand it, is because I read Anselm's, both of his books from cover to cover, and I saw what he was doing. I saw what was going on and what the context in which the ontological, or the context of his life in which the ontological argument found its genesis. Now, here's what I'm going to do. Let me give you the most basic definition of the Anselmic, A-N-S-E-L-M-I-C, Anselm, Saint Anselm of God, which, no, not real, I mean, kind of, but you got to see so much more to it. It's built on so many other things, so many other assumptions. But it says, point number one, even the fool understands the concept of God. Number two, a being that exists in reality is greater than one that exists only in the understanding. Now, we're going to stop there just for a minute, because this is the most important part. This is the most important move. And if you agree with number two, if you say that a being that exists in reality is greater than one that exists only in the understanding, with the key word being greater, and I'll explain that in just a moment. If you concede that, then you have conceded everything. But not only that, you have conceded a starting point for all of your understanding. I mean, from everything that God is to everything that we need to be to the reason why Christ had to die on the cross and why God himself had to come to us rather than any other methodology. There was no way that you could have had a second Adam that who was not God, because that couldn't have helped us. And I will understand that, but whenever we get that, I think we'll understand. I think if I do well here. Okay, so here's what we got to start with. Do you believe? Okay, here's the definition of God. The definition of God is that God is the greatest conceivable being. Do you agree with that? You'd say, yeah, of course. Okay, that's easy enough. I mean, if you don't agree with that, then of course we don't even know where we're going, because we got to be talking about the same basic definition of God. And there's really four different basic definitions of God you can have. You could say God is the greatest conceivable being, which is the Anselmic definition, kind of the history of Christianity definition that we've inherited in Christendom, but hasn't always necessarily been the only way we define it. Or you could say God is the greatest conceivable being, number one. Number two, God is that which we worship, which is a true definition of God as well. I mean, if you worship something, you can call it your God. You don't necessarily have to have that which you worship be the greatest conceivable being, but it doesn't mean the greatest conceivable being is no longer God in the way Anselm was defining it. So God can be that which you worship, or God can be that which is just more powerful than you, has some type of supernatural, mystical, or ethereal existence. So let's say an angel or a demon, they present themselves as a god and say, how do I know you're a god? They say, because watch all these powers that I have that you don't have. So I am more powerful than you, therefore I am your god at least. And you can concede at that point, okay, that's a definition of God too. So you've got greatest conceivable being. You've got God as that which we worship. God as that which is more powerful than us, or celestial, or supernatural. And then finally, you got the creator. You can go all the way back and just say God is the creator. I think number one and number four are the same thing. So I think you could push this down to two, because the greatest conceivable being is the creator by definition, but at the same time, if I collapse that, then I can find ways to collapse number two and three into number one as well. But so let's just stick with these four. Whenever Anselm is defining this, what he is saying is God as the greatest conceivable being. Can we both agree that that is what I am trying to prove? Must exist. He must exist. You say, yeah, that's okay, I'm good with that. And then he says, okay, what if that God only exists in your mind? Would that be greater than one that exists in reality? And if you say, no, one that exists in is greater in reality. Because, you know, you want to have existence tied onto it, not just existence in my mind, that's a limited existence. You want to have unlimited existence, which is what God would have. And so, of course, existing in reality is greater than existing in my mind only. Now, set that aside, and let's go to a different place. Okay, this word greater than, lesser than. Whenever you say, is God, is it greater than being only inside your mind, being also in reality, you're stating your understanding of a measurement. And in that measurement, you can't have any type of greater or lesser than unless you have an idea of a infinite, a perfect, whatever the perfect is, then you can have a starting point to say what is lesser than. Whenever you start with perfection, if I was to say, is it good? Is it greater or lesser for one to be morally kind to their children? Is it greater? I'm glad I did a first run out of this. Think of it this way. Anytime you measure something, you are assuming that that thing can be measured. And whenever you measure something, you're assuming that there is the perfection of whatever it is you're measuring. So if I was to say, is LeBron James better than Michael Jordan? An absurd, preposterous question. You would have to say, well, what is better? What makes someone better? That's kind of the idea. You have to have criteria for which one can be better or worse. Like if I was to say, let's take something more simple. Is purple bluer than green? You see what I'm saying? If your standard is blue, which one is closest to blue? Blue or green? You'd say, purple. Purple looks more like blue. Somebody else might say green does, but either way, you have the standard, which is what? Blue. You're trying to measure it up to something. There has to be an ultimate starting point, or at least the assumption that it is out there somewhere. You don't have to know what that starting point is. You don't have to be able to define it completely. You just have to get closer to it than something else. So it's really easy when we're talking about how somebody might be tall. You know, then we're saying, what is the standard of tall? And you say, well, in humans, it's about 8 foot. If somebody's 8 foot, they're really tall. You're not going to get much taller than that. And so then whenever you come to somebody who's 6'5", 6'10", you're like, yeah, that's tall. You know, especially because out there, relative to that, there are people who are, you know, 4 foot, 5 foot, and all kinds of, all heights in between. And so you're always starting with a standard of measurement. You don't necessarily have to have it perfect, but you have to have a direction to go in to be able to define better or worse. And once you have a direction to go in to be able to define better or worse, you automatically have set that somewhere out there, there is the perfection of whatever it is you're looking for. Now, you can't really say it like being tall, because the perfection of being tall, what is that? Is that being infinite? You'd say, no, it's not being infinite. You're just saying bigger is better. And then you have to principalize that and say, in what way is bigger better? And you say, well, bigger is better whenever it comes to many things in life, a bigger house or a bigger universe. And you say, well, why is a bigger universe better? And you say, well, because it necessitates a bigger and better God. And it all kind of leads to the similar places, you know, whether it is better, stronger, faster, bluer, more powerful. All of these things have to have a standard that meet somewhere, that have a perfection. Otherwise, you are relatively defining things. If you can actually say something is better than something, if you can actually say something is bluer than something else, then you do have a standard somewhere. Even if that standard has never been seen, you just know it has to be. And this is part of our social contract that we live in. It's part of the assumptions that we make. I don't have to sit here and argue with you about this any more than I have to argue with you about the law of non-contradiction. It just is. It's one of those things that nothing works without it. So if you don't have the standard for something, then you cannot measure that standard. I like to look at it like an infinitely deep hole, okay? If you're standing on the outside of an infinitely deep hole and you're looking down the hole and you got your little stopwatch and you say, okay, I'm going to time how fast you can jump out of this infinitely deep hole. And, you know, person sitting there may scratch their head and say, okay, I don't really understand that. Well, what do you mean you don't understand? I want you to jump out of this infinitely deep hole. Well, that doesn't make any sense. How is one going to jump out of an infinitely deep hole? You say, well, you got the out, which is defined right here. But you're going to have to jump out of it. And then the person says, wait, jumping assumes a final point of perfection. Either outside or inside, it doesn't matter. If you're telling me to come out of something, it means there is the ability to define what it means to be in something, at the bottom of something. So therefore, I can't jump out of an infinitely deep hole. It's infinitely deep and therefore has no measurements and ultimately has no out once you are in that way at least. So you have to have the bottom and you have to have the top. You have to have that which you are jumping to and that which you are jumping from. And this is the same thing whenever you begin to talk about many of our concepts. If you keep this in your mind throughout the day, throughout the weeks, you'll start to see this arise. You'll say, what am I measuring this against? Everything I do, everything I say, every sentence that I'm involved in and every thought that I have normally has some type of assumed measurements that tell us there is something better or worse. There's something to move toward. Now, it doesn't mean we have to be right about it necessarily, because you can get your ups and your downs mixed up. But at the same time, it still means there is an ultimate perfection somewhere, even if I misdefine it, that I'm trying to define it against. And if I don't have that ultimate perfection, then there's no possibility of me making the statement that there is better or worse. There is in or out. There is blue or green. So, back to Anselm's definition of God. If God is the greatest conceivable being, people would say, wait a minute, you just smuggled in something, which I did. And I'm not trying to trick you or anything. I'm just working within the social contract in which you exist every day. You already believe in better or worse or greater or lesser. And I asked you in point number two, is it better to exist than to not exist? And you say, yeah, it is. It is. I'm willing to concede that. Well, if you're willing to concede that, then you've just conceded everything. You've just given me everything. Because I got number three, if God exists only in our minds, then we could conceive of something greater, namely that which exists in our minds and in reality. Okay, I don't think you need point number three, but at the same time, it kind of closes the gap some and helps people to understand. So if it only exists in my mind, you're not thinking of the right thing. If you say, No, God doesn't exist. He only exists in people's minds and their hopes. And I say, wait, you're thinking of the wrong God. Because you've already conceded that it's greater to be outside the mind than only inside the mind. Maybe both. Okay, cover both of them. Your existence would be greater if it is in both the mind and outside the mind. Existence is greater. That's the key. And if existence is greater, then you have to say, at that point, there is a measurement for existence. There is an ultimate of existence, namely, that which exists in and of itself. That's the key. Something just is. Something is perfect because it's always been perfect, and it is the standard by which all other things are measured. Anytime something is bad or worse, it is measured against perfection. That's the outside of the whole. That's the perfection. And you're pushing a ruler down, but you have the starting point. You have the ending point. And so God is the top of the ruler on everything. Anselm, whenever he's talking about this in an earlier book, calls these great making properties, or he refers to them. That's the concept. These are great making properties. In other words, these are properties that you would say, and you can boil it down into principles or properties. It becomes a little bit squirrely whenever you try to get an actual ruler and say, well, is 10 inches bigger, better than 20 inches? And you'd say, yeah, I guess so. Well, in what context? For what instrument? For what is it you're talking about? From what perspective? And so at that point, you have the principle, but you're trying to figure out what the principle is, and you're trying to place it against that principle. Well, that's a great making property. We're trying to find what makes us greater, what makes things greater. And once you find that property, let's say, even being right, correctness or wrongness, you'd have to say there's an ultimate correctness. There's an ultimate right answer, and we're moving towards it. Even if we perceive of it wrong, we have to start with that preconception, social contract in a way, a philosophical social contract, by the way. You have to start with that, and you have to say, I am trying to move to something better in every way. Something prettier, something more morally good, something more correct, something more bright. Whenever you have, the classic illustration of this type of stuff, whenever you're talking about a great making property, although not necessarily, it does work, but it's a property in a different way. Let's take heat, for instance. You have heat. that exists. It has an ontology about it. It has an actual existence. You can measure it. You can tell what it is, why it is, that kind of stuff. Cold, you can't. Cold, there's really no such thing as cold. This is the negation of heat. Cold is simply the negation of heat. And so all you're doing whenever you're saying something is cold is you're saying it has less heat. Well, I'm colder. Well, that means I have less heat. And so you have to have the ultimate standard, which is heat. And like I said, you don't have to know the infinite of that. You just have to assume that there has to be a starting point, a perfection of whatever it is. Same thing with light. Light is the classic example. Light exists, darkness does not. Darkness is simply the negation of light. And so you have more dark and more dark and more dark. Really what you're saying is less light and less light and less light. And what you're assuming is ultimately out there, there is the perfection of light. There is the source of light. Everything has to have its source for its principle, for its great making property. Otherwise, you're on a relative ruler hanging out in midair and you can't really do anything. But everybody knows there is. So that's why we talk this way. That's why everything we say and do has this assumption built in. We believe there are great making properties. We exist as if there are great making properties. We try to become what we become because we believe it's in the direction of great making properties, at least whenever we're acting responsibly. So you have that. Then you have evil. Evil and good, the basic existence whenever it comes to God. The basic understanding whenever it comes to God that Augustine did so much to introduce us to in his Confessions, which is a great dialogue between him and God, and he talks about him wrestling with this. And his idea of evil really kept him away from understanding God and understanding the Christian idea of God until he came to the conclusion that evil was not a thing, that evil was a negation of a good, and there has to be a perfect good, and you are the perfect good, O God. You are that which all other things are measured against, and they're either closer to you, more like you, or further away from you, less like you. Good or evil, perfect or imperfect, blue or purple, tall or short, better or worse, all of these things come into this great making property. And you say, whenever you've defined a great making property, you have to have that object that is a static object, meaning it exists in and of itself. It has aseity. It is of itself. It is not measured according to anything else. It doesn't from the outside in define itself and say this is good and that is bad. It is the good. It is the perfection. It is the infinite. And whether you believe it or not, you believe that stuff because you work under that assumption every day. There's not one of you out there who could say, no, I don't ascribe to that. Then I would say you're a pure relativist in every way. And I could probably say, is it better that you don't ascribe to it? And then if you say yes, you're in trouble. You just conceded it. So there's nobody that can, because that's the social contract. It's the philosophical law of non-contradiction. The moment you begin to try to prove it wrong, you have proven it right, because you have used its own principles to argue against it. If you were to say it's better. So whenever you have right, wrong, any of these things, you have great making properties. And in the end, a great making property has to have the infinite. And this is the key right here. The infinite of whatever it is has to be all encompassed within one greatest conceivable being. They have to have the great making properties have to have their perfection in the one greatest conceivable being. And so now we go back to the argument. Hopefully this is getting us somewhere. We go back to the argument, and the first one is this. Even a fool understands the concept of God. Number two, being that he exists in a being that exists in reality is greater than one that exists only in the understanding. Like I said, I got you there. If you say, yes, it is greater to exist in reality, what are you doing? You're pulling out a measurement, or you're in the hole and you are, you're saying, I'm going to jump out. And if you're able to jump out, then you're assuming there's a starting point or an ending point. You're measuring it somehow. What are you measuring? You're measuring at this point, you are saying existence itself has a better and a less, a greater and a lesser. And if you say that, then you have to have the perfection of existence. You have to have that ruler. This one here is a Stanley 16 foot. This one that I have to pull out philosophically says existence on it. And it's saying that this is a great making property, existence itself. And therefore, existence itself has to have perfection. And by definition, this is the key, by definition, that is the definition I'm talking about whenever I'm arguing for God. That one that exists perfectly without lack. The only thing you could possibly do, and I've thought about this a lot, and say, well, how do you get out of this? I don't think you do. I really don't. I think you can try to argue yourself out in the moment, but then later on you'll figure out you don't really believe that. You just tried to get out of the argument because you found yourself trapped. You could say that, well, you're saying existence is really greater or lesser, that it has you can really have a ruler that says existence on it. Yes, I'm saying it's better. I don't believe that. I don't think to exist, to not exist, who cares? You know, to exist a long time, to exist a short time, who cares? To exist before and after, or just before, who cares? You're saying, all right, I'm taking away that measuring ruler because you beat me. And I'd say, no, because your thoughts will always go back to this. You'll always say existence is greater than non-existence. I know you might not. You might say, no, I'm going to back off on that because I think that's what I do philosophically whenever I'm arguing against God. I have to do that. And I was like, yeah, okay, but you don't do that in reality. You act as if existence is a great making property. You work your life as if existence is a great making property. As a matter of fact, if you are a basic atheist who lives in a world today, the way they reject God, they're always saying that the principal being is whatever helps us to thrive. What does to thrive mean? Give me that measurement. Give me the ultimate of thriving. Well, it's going to be existing. I mean, thriving is not going to be thriving all in your mind and not in reality. You're going to always have that light by which darkness is measured by. And I'm telling you, existence will always fall within that category. So I gotcha. I won. It's done. So setting that aside, hopefully that helps you to understand the ontological argument. It is the very understanding that to exist is better than not exist. There is the ultimate existence. Otherwise, you don't have this better or worse. But I think it's much broader than that, because I don't think we think of God in such pure Anselmic terms, or really going back to Augustine and the scholastic reformer. I don't think you have to believe God this way. I just think it's helpful. It's very helpful to understand that this is one of the greatest conceivable being understanding of God is. I'm not saying that's what you have to start with, because I think a lot of us just start with our love for him and we just know that he's there. I don't think we work all this out, but I think it's very helpful to work this out, because it does create a closed loop to where God must exist by definition. It helps you to understand so much more of the Christian faith. What is the Christian faith? Well, the Christian faith is that perfection, the very definition, the ruler of every great-making property, every moral compass, the North Star of every single thing that is good, better, or worse, the North Star by which that is measured by is perfect, period. by definition. It's not he decides to be perfect and he says, you know, I'm going to be perfect because I'm self-righteous and I'm just going to stay this way and you have to be perfect like me. No, he is by definition perfection. Therefore, you and I, he is by definition sitting outside that hole. And it is an infinitely deep hole because you and I have jumped into it and we are falling. And as sinners, there's nothing we can do because we cannot get to perfection. We cannot stop. All we're doing is falling further. Okay, you might be able to slow yourself down. Maybe, you know, resist the wind as you're going down a little bit and you fall slower than somebody else. But you ain't getting out of that hole. There's no way out of that hole. You say, well, I'll jump out. No, you can't jump out because it is bottomless. It is sin. It has put you in a predicament where in order to be with God outside the hole, you have to be perfect like him. So how do we get there if we can't jump out? We can't work ourselves to God, which is the key with Christianity. You can't work yourself to God. You can't do enough good. It'll never balance the scales. You can never even get balanced. You're just still falling. And that is why you and I come to God and say, the best we got is to yell at the one who hears everything, who hears perfection, who is the very definition of hearing and has hearing, which is understanding, by his own being as a consequence of who he is. And you yell to him, you say, help me. There's nothing I can do. And God can't really do anything either unless what does he have to do? He has to jump in that hole. But you know what? He has to be anchored to the top. And God is anchored to the top. Christ is anchored to the top because he never did any wrong. Yet at the same time, he jumped in the same hole as us. And he fell and he got pulled out. He already pulled himself out. But he's anchored to God. He's anchored to perfection. He's anchored to that which is the ruler of all things. And so whenever he brings that ruler back in and you're connected to it, there's a way for it to come back in. And so you have to have a situation where God himself, the perfection himself, becomes what we are in that hole falling and grabs a hold of us and by his own strength, by his own perfection, brings us up to be identify with him. We are under his umbrella. We are now the perfection, not in a some type of foreign or spurious way. We are actually perfected in Christ. He doesn't just say, nah, let's just call him perfected. You know, since you got him, I'm gonna be nice and let you call him perfected. No, he perfects you. You have to be found in him because the old Adamic race, the old Adam jumped in and all we've done has been born to him on the way down. And Christ has to become a man, but he has to be anchored at the top. So the God-man, you call out to God, you recognize you're falling, first thing you got to do, you have to say, beat on your chest and say, have mercy on me, the sinner. That's the thing. If you want to know what distinguishes you or Christianity from everything else, let me tell you right now, have you called out to God and said, God, I'm toast. I can't do anything. I can't rely upon my own self. I have to have you jump in here and get me. Will you come in here and get me, God? Christ, come and get me. That's the difference. Everybody else thinks they're going to get out. They're going to slow down. They're going to hopefully not have fallen too far away from perfection. And whoever does not have Christ, does not call upon Christ to come get him, will be judged by how far he fell. And he was already born fallen. So, yeah, it's hopeless. It's hopeless. Every other religion says, I can do it. I'm going to do the things that are right to make up for the bad that I did. No, you already jumped in the hole. Nothing you can do. You have to have the ruler pull you back up. Okay, guys, I thought I would just take time and hopefully give you some good information about the ontological argument. If you have any questions, this is my Patreon. Ask it down there at patreon.com/cmichaelpatton. I'm doing this just for my patrons right now. I might put this out on YouTube later on, but just thought I would give you an explanation. Thank you guys so much for all your help. I know I ask for it all the time. I love doing what I'm doing. I pray that I'm able to do this for the rest of my life until the day I die. Just pray. Continue to pray for what I'm doing if you believe in it. Support. Thank you so much for the support. Thank you for allowing me to work so hard on this church history stuff that I've been doing. I think it's completely unique, and we're leaving behind something amazing that has never been done. And we're going to leave behind a lot of stuff because I've got a few years left. You know, I've got a good 20, 30 years left, and I can do a lot of these church history books that that organize the great people, so many great people, and have us see our heritage. We got a good heritage. We really do. It's an amazing heritage. Put it up against anybody, anything. Okay, guys, we'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Theology